Previously on the Nighthawks podcast. Speaking of Harold Ramis, Matt, we mentioned kind of the state of the Ghostbusters franchise. We know it's Jason Reitman that's doing it, son of Ivan Reitman, who directed the originals. We've got the returning cast.
It's a revival of an 80s property that has one of the kids from Stranger Things in it. That was an intentional marketing synergy, you know? I feel torn about it because I was, as we say, over the hump on the 2016 Ghostbusters.
I was too.
I like the property. I'm glad it's getting some stuff.
You know, it was always one that felt like it needed to be a trilogy, and I think that's just me growing up in the Back to the Future, Star Wars, Indiana Jones era of the 90s. Everything seemed to come out in trilogies there for a while. The Paul Feig Ghostbusters, also known politically as the female Ghostbusters. I think it got a lot of unfair panning. That being said, it's also not that great. The big controversy with that, the elephant in the room that we're kind of tap dancing around, is that it was the all-female Ghostbusters. The least of the problems in this movie was the cast. The cast was fun. The cast worked for me. I liked the cast.
There was some unnecessary CGI that was a little rough. There was a lot of stuff that was really that Ben Stiller person that can't stop and explain themselves.
Honestly, my biggest problem is there is just a lot of hacky writing in there. The cast should probably be celebrated for making this movie as good as it was. Because Kate McKinnon in this is a treasure. Leslie Jones is a treasure. It wasn't a great movie, and honestly, I don't know that it was that hot of an idea. Because when you do something like that with a property that's so well-beloved as Ghostbusters, the yardsticking already begins at the casting. Is this undoing the 2016 Ghostbusters?
If it erases Ghostbusters 2016, it is that movie's fault for not placing itself in continuity and trying to be a hard reboot. I think that movie could have helped itself a lot if it acknowledged the continuity. Just like have them inherit the firehouse from their dead uncle, you know, which appears to be what happens in this one.
My ultimate take on the Ghostbusters new trailer is I'm just going to wait and see. This piqued my nostalgia. I think it did exactly what it was intending to. I trust Jason Reitman. This is a dude whose career I've been following for a long time.
The ticket is essentially sold already.
Happy New Year!
We've been waiting for a long time. Yes, we've been waiting for a long, long time. We've been waiting. For a long time, but we ain't gonna wait no more. We're getting ready to rock and roll. We're gonna 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3. What is the reason everybody should be shaking in the house tonight? And you should wear your favorite lady and promise her you do it right. Tell Fat Jack to jump back and give you a shot of some blue. So you can party to some stomp down, butt bump and rock and roll, rhythm and blues. But the boys are back in town.
The Night Hops podcast is intended for you, but not your children. My dad and Matt say bad words in this episode, which isn't good for kids like me to hear. Listener discretion is advised.
Because you seem distracted lately, Matt.
Hold on just a second. I'm getting some beverages and stuff.
You son of a bitch.
I'm going to get an apple and I'm going to eat it on mic. Might get a jar of mayonnaise and plunge my hand in and out of it.
Callback.
Okay, so I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start a TikTok where I review apples.
Like the fruit?
Yeah, there's a lot of apples out there, man.
There are. Much like I approach any restaurant that I'm going to a second time, I find the one thing I like, I try none of the rest, and I just keep with it. I've been on Fuji apples for years.
I'm trying one right now called a Choreo.
Is it crisp and delicious?
It's very crisp. It's very juicy. It's a little bland. It's neither sweet nor sour.
Kind of like digging into a jicama?
A little bit. More character than a jicama. Anyway, this is Nighthawks episode.
Yeah, I don't even know anymore.
Afterlife. More like corpse fucking. 3, 2, 1.
Coming to get you, Barbara. I am bugged. Beyond recall.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
Now, there's only two of us here tonight, and we're going to lock ourselves in my room.
Men drilling by night, underground meeting places, pagan rituals. Well, anything's possible.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is a slightly more formal Nighthawks podcast than the previous episode. If you are not...
I want a bow tie now.
If you are not hip to what's been going on, we have been off for a little while. We had some family stuff come up. I had a son. That's the big news. He is well and healthy. That is the big news. There was a little gray area in the middle. That's what we're addressing. We were away. We're back. But things are still a little in the lurch right now as far as my schedule goes. So we're just kind of pumping out a couple of episodes here to remind you that we are still alive. We still love you and we're still doing this. But Matt, I'm going to out you here. Matt was feeling a little tired tonight. We've recorded two episodes this evening. It's late. It's past midnight. We're doing this in verite. It's a little
accuracy.
Yes. we're doing this true to style. This is an honest to God Nighthawks middle of the night conversation. We're still here. We're doing this, but I could not let this go, Matt. Ghostbusters Afterlife has dropped. As fortune may have it, this is the second movie I have seen in theater in 2 years. This was the special treat that I got for myself. I have watched it. Matt watched it a little closer to release, which was a couple of weeks ago. We did a whole thing where we prefaced, I think it was our Ice Harvest episode, with a lot of Ghostbusters Afterlife trailer talk. This is a movie that was delayed because of COVID. It was highly anticipated and kept largely undercover, successfully so. So I think there's a lot to talk about here, and I wanted to do that now. But like I said, I'm going to take it easy on myself in the edit here. I don't know how much time I can commit to the edit right now, so this is going to be kind of a dress-down episode. How have you been?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't manufacture any humans.
Matt is still working that stand-up circuit, though. You have actually, you did the Free Kittens show, I know, there in Salt Lake City, Utah. Have you had any more gigs? Like, how are things on that front?
I'm taking it a little slow lately. I don't know. There's still a horrible plague cloud over everything, so.
Yeah, you know, and this is something that, Matt, I have to give you credit for. I have not even attempted stand-up since I was still a teenager, or I might have been in my early 20s. When I ripped off an entire Dana Gould sketch and did it at an open mic night at a coffee house. Dana, I apologize. That was wrong. But you have given me kind of this window into the Salt Lake City comedy scene. We're in a few group chats together. We're in a few Facebook groups together. And I'm just kind of your sidekick when it comes to stand-up comedy. I'm your hype man. I am your pallbearer, if you will. It's really given me that insider's glimpse into stand-up comedy. Now, this is my impression. I don't know what the actuality is, though, so I'm gonna default to you. I seem to notice that while there is some live comedy content out there, it's really hit or miss. The COVID precautions are a little all over the place. But there are also far fewer online Zoom Skype mics, and it seems like demand for that is no longer there. Is that a fair read?
I don't know. Some of them are sticking around. I think everything is, I won't say forever changed, but there's going to be some adjusting.
Can you still do it as a fundraiser? Can you still get Chris Rock, Eliza Schlesinger, Paul Scheer, and a cast and cavalcade of people from their living rooms and raise a bunch of money for, you know, ALS or something?
I mean, I could never do that. I only know one of those people, and he won't call me back anymore. I don't know, man.
Well, I've been told that there's a plague against comedy where you can't make fun of anybody anymore, and it's everybody's too sensitive, and nobody can laugh anymore, and that seems to be a narrative that is being propagated, and If you had a comment, I was going to allow for that. But if you'd rather not go there, I understand that too.
All I have to say is I kind of actually wish a few people would get canceled. Like, it'd be cool if somebody would get canceled so we'd have a clear-cut example of what it actually looks like. if someone had to walk around with a big C on their forehead, like, no dogs allowed.
No dogs allowed.
But they seem to just get $50 million Netflix deals. You don't want to give me, you don't got enough tape.
Well, in that case, Matt, our movie tonight is Ghostbusters Afterlife, the long-awaited three-peat, threequel of the Ghostbusters series. Ghostbusters came out in 1984. Ghostbusters 2 was like 89. And then we have then waited about 30 years for the latest adventure in the Ghostbusters realm. We did have an animated series for a while. And then that animated series spun off another animated series. And then there was an attempted reboot in 2016 with an all-female cast, restarting everything from the word go. It was a remake, a reboot in just about every sense of the word. Met with some controversy, and we talked about that particular movie a little bit when we discussed the Ghostbusters Afterlife trailer. But what I will say is I'm not going to give any spoilers in front here. Matt, I don't think you are either. And if we have something to say about some spoilers, we'll give you a verbal warning. If you are unwatched, this will be a safe episode to listen to, perhaps until a point. Matt, I'm just going to hit you. How did it leave you?
It's all right.
Yeah? Okay. Now, just so I can get a barometer, what was your reaction to 2016 Ghostbusters?
It's all right.
Okay.
I articulated this someplace else, so forgive me, dear listener, if you've already been subjected to it on our Twitter or something.
But which has been more active lately, by the way. We've been a little more active on the social medias.
How I would describe it is I would give it about the same net numerical score as the 2016 incarnation, which has been stylized as Ghostbusters Answer the Call, or just Ghostbusters 2016. I would give them about the same 1 to 100 score, which is about a 77, but for entirely different reasons.
You know, I think that's all fair. And I don't even know that I would necessarily fight your score on that. I'm not going to take you to the fantastic debates and go a few rounds with you over this, but I think I might rate it a little higher. I think I might give it something in the low to mid 80s. I think it left me a little better than Ghostbusters 2016, but I also was kind of a Ghostbusters 2016 defender on certain levels. Both of them had problems that just watching them as a critic, I'm like, come on, guys, what are we doing here? And like you said, for different reasons, they were different moments. I think at times Ghostbusters 2016 was a little too shticky. I think Ghostbusters Afterlife was a little too shticky in places. But there were different levels of shticky. It's a weird one, but I think I'm going to have to give it to Ghostbusters Afterlife in that I am much more excited for a possible sequel or an expansion on this story arc. I think there's a little more meat there than kind of retreading what's already been done. And so that's why I think I'm a little more excited with this one. But I do have to say, this was my treat to myself after 2 years of only seeing one other movie in the theater. So I kind of went in preloaded, really wanting to enjoy this. I did really enjoy it. I don't know that this is the Ghostbusters sequel that I wanted. I don't know that it's the best Ghostbusters sequel that could have been produced, but I'm certainly not going to be able to do any better as a non-filmmaker. What I will say is I think this is a sufficient, functional, fun, worthy reboot of a potential expanded property. I know that any sequels to this, nothing's been announced. But by and large, I enjoyed it. I liked it more than I didn't like it. I had a very good time at the movies. I lost myself for 2 hours after a few very trying weeks, and that was no small feat. So I've got to give this one a thumbs up, to borrow from Siskel. Or if I'm going to borrow from the Leonard Maltin oft underused hot or not scale he had on Hot Ticket, I would give this a hot. But I was also fine with the fact that it took me a couple of weeks to see it, too. So Yeah, good movie. I'll tell you what it didn't do. It actually didn't tickle my nostalgia button the way I thought it was going to.
Because it wasn't nostalgic for the right shit.
That left me a little wanting, but I think that was probably to the movie's betterment that it didn't go there.
It was generically nostalgic.
Speak on that.
I mean, we're not diverging that much, but I'm going to find some fault here. Okay. I just brushed the mic with my nose. This is nasal ASMR.
Yeah, you like guys with noses?
The core setup here is that the Ghostbusters themselves essentially busted themselves out of business and dealt with the immediate insurgency depicted in Ghostbusters 1 and 2. And then general spectral activity was sufficiently curtailed that they moved on to other things. They were no longer full-time Ghostbusters. Ghostbusting itself being a pre-viral phenomenon, largely faded from the public consciousness. And we skip to now, skipping all the way over the 2016 movie, just deciding to set it out of continuity. They don't mesh up at all. Which the 2016 movie was a bit loose with the franchise details in the first place. Like, it was a weird soft reboot that sort of wanted to use imagery from the first one, but didn't. Anyway, the setup here at its simplest level would be that one of the Ghostbusters has died of natural causes.
And if you've kept up with the actors from the series, you know who that is.
Yeah, yeah. It was Ivan Reitman, who played Egon, who died in real life.
No, Ivan Reitman is the director. It was Harold Ramis was the actor.
Sorry. Yeah. You're correct.
Ivan Reitman, by the way, still very much with us.
But yeah, it was Harold Ramis who played Egon, who died in real life. It is the story of his estranged family receiving their inheritance. And of course, like, in the basement is a bunch of inexplicable ghostbusting equipment.
You're a great mom.
I don't know. I'm fine with Trevor, but with Phoebe, she really keeps me on the outside.
That's normal. She's an awkward, nerdy kid.
Maybe a new home can be an opportunity to start fresh. I just wish she'd get into some trouble.
There's still time.
Doing here in Somerville anyway?
We're completely broke, and our grandfather left us this creepy old farmhouse in the middle of nowhere.
Your father wasn't much of a homemaker. He could hardly keep the power on.
You're saying he left us nothing?
Well, I wouldn't say nothing.
You went with station wagon?
It's the only one that had an engine.
What is happening here?
Somehow, a town with no fault lines is shaking on a daily basis.
Maybe it's the apocalypse. Egon came out here for a reason.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
Oh my God.
You guys hear that?
Something's coming.
The whole city.
It's like The Walking Dead.
Closed.
It is also a transposition because he retired to small town America. It is a transposition from New York City to
small town Oklahoma.
Smallville type town in the middle of Oklahoma. Oklahoma, Oklahoma, Oklahoma.
And see, and I think you're almost even giving that setup too much, because that is our setup, but that's just, it's just the setup. Really, the A story here is about the errors kind of picking through these devices and then curtailing a new insurgency of Gozerism. What I love about this is that No, it did not make me nostalgic for Ghostbusters. When the proton pack charges up for the first time, it didn't give me the little tingling sensation that I get sometimes when Star Wars or Marvel does a callback. That stuff was all handled well, but that's not the part of this movie that I was interested in. And it's because we have really good performances from our A characters here, and the A characters here are still not who you're expecting based on the advertising for this movie. So it was a lot of surprises. It was a lot of subversion of my expectations. How much of that was intentional and how much of that was just kismet, I don't know. But at no point did I feel like, it's good to be watching the Ghostbusters series again. I'm like, hey, this is a pretty good story to tell in the Ghostbusters universe. And I think that's why it worked for me.
I mean, I felt that way for a little bit of it. Like, I felt that way for about half of it. I do get, like, a lot of... Like, if you're a certain age, and it's not you're an adult or even a kid, a four-year-old Matt was not taken to Ghostbusters in theaters, right? Two things happened with Ghostbusters. It had a pretty successful afternoon/Saturday morning cartoon, which I revisited in a preparatory fashion, and I was amazed at how bad the character animation was, but how the ghosts and stuff were even weirder than I remembered them. It has very grotesque, kind of like very reminiscent of like the R. Crumb or even like a Rat Rod style art. They're a lot like the trip sequence in Beavis and Butthead Do America.
Yeah, good call.
What is it, Egon? Did you find our stuff?
Not exactly. Here, look at this. What do you make of it?
Well, it's dark and it's deep. I'd make it a hole, but that's just an opinion, you understand?
Exactly. This is where the ghost was hiding. According to these readings, it was a sleeping ghost. Certain kinds of ghosts spend eternity looking for a nice, quiet place to sleep. When they're awakened, they're very cranky.
So you think it's noise that makes this thing violent?
Almost certainly.
I better warn the others. Come in, Ray. Come in, Ray. You there?
Yeah, Peter. What do you want?
Shh. Stop that.
Ray, it hates noise, so be quiet, okay?
Oh, okay. Got it, Peter. Over and out. You know, Winston, I was thinking, maybe losing our proton packs was a good thing. Maybe we should defeat this thing with our wits, our courage, our imagination, our... You're right. Let's find those proton packs and blow this pot stand.
So that show that was on afternoons was what put all the merch and equipment and stuff in my head. That was where you got the idea in your head of the proton pack and the ghost traps and stuff, and you wanted those toys that were from the cartoon. This is another one where if you dissect the actual marketing arc, nobody took us to Ghostbusters when we were kindergartners to see Sigourney Weaver in a thin gown getting borderline molested by Bill Murray, right? That was not the mode of a movie that you took your kids to. But then what happened, we went cartoon first and then movie on VHS, and Ghostbusters is a great party movie. It's a dialogue-driven, like a snappy comedy that has a nice mix of very funny script, you know, the infamous, like, where do these stairs go? They go up, like all those quotations, you know? The infamous kaiju Stay Puft Marshmallow Man. Did we rule him? We ruled him a kaiju, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
We can check the tape if we need to, but I think we did. It was this like really good, really four quadrant genre movie is rare. There's not really a lot of movies with like hard special effects in like that first library scene in Ghostbusters is actually authentically quite creepy. You know, well, get her, that was your plan. But the script of Ghostbusters is like one of those infinitely quotable, it has one-lineritis really bad, right? As you can, just bringing it up, you know. We didn't actually love Ghostbusters when it came out. We loved it when we were 12. And as famous, what was it? Was it Freaks and Geeks where they all wanted to watch Ghostbusters? They had a Ghostbusters party every so often. It was a home video champion.
You know? For sure, yeah.
And Ghostbusters 2 had come out, which I like Ghostbusters 2. Ghostbusters 2 is a little cornier than the first one and kind of a rehash. But I like it when they make the... the Statue of Liberty get up and walk and stomp on some shit because God damn it, they love New York.
Yeah, it's a Jackie Wilson. You know? It's great. No, it gets some hate, and it's not quite the animal that Ghostbusters 1 was, and I think that's why it gets that hate. But I think that's also what gives Ghostbusters the pass to do the shit that it does. Ghostbusters 1 and Ghostbusters 2, not quite the same animal. Ghostbusters 2 and the Ghostbusters animated series, also not quite the same animal. Not to mention the fact that there was the weird rights over the word Ghostbusters. It was the real Ghostbusters was the cartoon adaptation of this film. There was also the Filmation Ghostbusters series, which was based on the old Ghostbusters children's television show from way back when. And that was an exposure to something I had never seen before.
Let's go, Ghostbusters!
Very dusty, very corny property to happen to coincidentally be named Ghostbusters. And when Ghostbusters was in the ramp up, the people that had the thinnest grasp over the copyright of it just spun up some quick trash to make sure they got a payout.
Yeah. You know?
It did involve a gorilla that used tools and drove a car. So I will forgive it a lot for that.
But I do have early memories of Ghostbusters 1. But I liked it for the reasons that a 5 or 6 year old would like it. And it's because it had a giant monster at the end. It had monsters that you shoot with lasers. And I was very attracted to that. But the entire basis of my, how do I know the characters' names? Why do I know what a proton pack is? What is the lore of a ghost? What do ecto goggles do? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That all came from the animated series. And the animated series was a weird bridge between the two films. And then it became apparent that the sequel, the second movie, was not going to acknowledge the animated series. And so it was a weird way of playing with what we now recognize as God bless Marvel introducing the multiverse, saying, yeah, we can have 3 simultaneous Spider-Man properties and people aren't going to get confused anymore. We have a system for this.
That's almost too much credit. I think they just decided to.
Oh yeah, it happened entirely by accident. But
you know,
I think it worked.
I think I remember really lusting after like those toys, like and like we wanted, like I had a lot of building toys because my parents wanted me to be smart. And like a proton pack and a ghost trap. That's the first thing I tried to make with like Kinects, Erector, Constructs, Legos, whatever I had. I was trying to make some Ghostbusting equipment. And I see that thread through the community here. And like, this is a kind of divisive movie because the nostalgia heroine in it really pleased some of the hardcore. Like, I have buddies that are like Ghostbusters. There's an actual cosplaying organization you can be in, like the Stormtrooper Regiment, the 501st or whatever.
Yeah, they're Ghostbusters of X. There is a Ghostbusters of Austin, a Ghostbusters of Los Angeles, etc., etc.
Yeah, so the people that were hardcore into that liked this movie because it did give them the fan service they wanted, right? Now, this is like, I don't want to harp back on our Suicide Squad thing, right? Where we were like, Suicide Squad empirically has structural problems and editing problems and production problems. But there are people that like it because it really gave them a 3-dimensional visualization of a comic book character as they had always envisioned it. Like, if you're a Harley Quinn fan, the Harley Quinn in Suicide Squad and later the Suicide Squad and et cetera and so forth, you know, Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn is the character. Like she understood the assignment, as the kids say, right?
I understood the assignment.
That's the same phenomenon here, is to a certain degree, the core idea is good. Let's have these people inherit this stuff in the heartland. And they find out that there's obviously, like, I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say that there's more going on than there appears to be. An elderly Ghostbuster did not just move to Oklahoma for no reason. And there are some interesting tie-ins to the mythology of the first two movies. But there are some problems in the movie. Okay, well, let's talk about a thing that worked first, which is the lead. who I maintain is...
The character's name is Phoebe, and she is the younger sister of Trevor, who is Finn Wolfhard of Stranger Things fame.
Trevor, no relation.
Right?
Because it's only your first names. Like, he would be... You'd be related if you had the same last name. Like, if it's Frank Trujillo, you'd be... But you're not, like, all people named Trevor aren't related. I don't know why I said that. Fuck.
Well, and then Phoebe's best friend is named Podcast. So I'm, like, double called out. But I'm also, like, oh, it's me on screen. And
you would definitely, like, that is you if you were, like, 8 now.
Are you kidding? That was me then. I was making radio programs on blank tapes from Radio Shack. It was great fun.
The actress's name is McKenna Grace, and she's great. And Carrie Coon is in here as her mom. And they kind of like, if this movie is a definite thing, this movie is guilty of is kind of wasting Carrie Coon.
Yeah.
But so Phoebe is excellent. Like she's very much the reincarnation of Egon, right? Nailed, you know?
Right.
And her stature as being like a plucky, I don't know, what is she 9'10"?
Thereabouts.
She's not, I don't know how canonically old she's quite. She says it in the movie too. She says, like, she's perfect as like a little bit of a neurodivergent character, but not to the point that she has the magic stereotype. She's very well handled. The actor walks a set of lines perfectly. She's very plausible. There's some kind of like physical stuff with her. Like the first time she steps out, she's got this proton back on that's big, almost as big as she is. She like sets her feet like a fireman with a fire hose and turns it on, right? 100% on board. Wonderful imagery. She nailed it.
Safety's off. Her feet are planted. Her face is poised. Will this be the moment of her death? Nobody knows. Best thing I've ever seen. Did I hit it? He didn't hit it! He destroyed it!
But then you have Finn Wolfhard, who is in here, and not that he didn't act well, but I can't escape the feeling that they wrote this movie around this character that was like Egon's granddaughter. And they realize, like, oh, this character kind of doesn't work as well as a high schooler. She's too manic pixie as a high schooler. Let's make her elementary age. And then they realize, like, oh, now she can't do anything. And if we have her parents take her everywhere, logically, her parents would just do the movie instead of the kid. Oh, let's give her an older brother who's barely old enough to drive. Like, Finn Wolfhard's character exists to be her chauffeur and open her pickle jars and grab things she can't reach off of high shelves. He's just Blaster to her master.
But who run Bartertown?
He does have a side plot, and it does introduce a love interest for him who is a more fun character that could have done his whole part.
Yeah.
You know, we don't... Her dad is the town sheriff, and he's Bokeem Woodbine, who you may remember from The Big Hit.
Nobody remembers The Big Hit, Matt.
Crunch, the customer of the month.
Trace Buster, Buster, Buster.
He only has a few lines, and for some reason he is the guy... Well, I won't get into it. You have this weird balance between they have a thing that works really well and then a thing that just kind of adds runtime. And there's some other stuff, like the mother has almost no reason for doing anything. I mean, the reasons exist in the plot, don't at me, right? They're broke, and that's why they move into their grandfather's haunted house, etc. You know, she just is not fleshed out. She's almost the pair of legs in a Tom and Jerry cartoon.
Well, I have a theory about that, but you know what? I'm going to save that for behind the spoiler curtain, which I think it's about time for if I check our record clock. So, Matt, do you have any final thoughts before we do that?
I've been griping about it, but I caution you that it's not bad. Like, you should still go to it and have fun.
I'm going to go so far as to say, Matt, I think I'm going to agree with every criticism you have of this movie. I'm going to save a lot of my criticisms for behind the spoiler curtain. I think we're going to find a lot of agreement there. But it didn't bother me as much. It didn't have the Suicide Squad fact. Wait. It did not have the small t Suicide Squad capitals problem where it took me out of the movie and I sat there.
You worked out a You walked out of Suicide Squad. You look like a person that touched a poop with their hand. Like, not a person that stepped in it. Like a person that touched a human poop with their hand. And you're looking at your hand with poop on it going, why was that on a high shelf? How did that get on the mantle where I keep my spare key? Who shit on my key?
That's all fair. Yes. I didn't get there with Ghostbusters Afterlife. It does have a bit of that Prometheus factor. I started picking it apart on the walk to the car, but none of the problems here bothered me. But I think they're perfectly valid if they bother you. I think there's a lot of criticism here. What I will say is hats off to Jason Reitman, Ivan's son, who did this. I think he pulled off a good reboot of Ghostbusters. I think it works. I think the overall look and feel looked good. I think the special effects were good. I think this was a good story. I'd like to see him take a crack at a sequel. But yeah, I think there were also some other problems here that just kind of plague big budget movies. And I wonder if it's probably not a little bit of studio interference. That's neither here nor there. That's my final thought. Matt, shall we drop that spoiler curtain?
I tried to stop them. He says they have a warrant.
Excuse me, this is private property.
Shut this off. Shut these all off.
I'm warning you, turning off these machines would be extremely hazardous.
I'll tell you what's hazardous. You're facing federal prosecution for at least a half a dozen environmental violations. Now, either you shut off these beams or we shut them off for you.
This is a high-voltage laser containment system. Simply turning it off would be like dropping a bomb in the city.
At ease, officer. I'm Peter Venkman. I think there's just been a slight misunderstanding, and I want to cooperate in any way that I can.
You had your chance to cooperate, but you thought it'd be more fun to insult me.
You shut that thing down, and we are not going to be held responsible
for
whatever happens.
No,
we won't be
held
responsible. Don't shut it off. I'm warning you.
Step aside.
If he does that again, you can shoot him.
You do your job, pencil neck. Don't tell me how to do mine.
Thank you, officer.
Shut it off!
Ka-chunk. I have flipped the switch. Okay, let's re-synopsize with the spoilers.
Egon's grandkids.
They inherit, they're broke. They're going underwater, living in the city, and they're broke and getting evicted. Close on the heels of eviction, they learn that they have a house in probate.
Egon has just died, like 2 weeks previous.
It is not a severe spoiler because it happens in the first few minutes. We see that Egon has effectively, like, he's built some sort of giant steampunk apparatus that encompasses a bunch of the farmland and is using it to try to trap some, like, large, powerful specter. And the equipment fails at a key moment and he is overcome. Then we cut to evicted family inherits house. Mother tells the kids that they're going to go clean out grandpa's house. And if he has any cool antiques or electronics, they're going to sell them. Halfway there, she reveals that, like, no, we're going to stay in it. Like, I've signed you up for school. We're going to have to live there for like a year. I don't know if I liked it or didn't like it, but she's like implied to be a pretty bad alcoholic. Like, she passes out at the table a couple times. Like, I don't know if she needs AA or if it's like stress over the circumstances, but they start by making her like a jokey wine mom, and then she's like passed out when the kids are in danger a couple times. Paul Rudd, who is the kids' science teacher and becomes sort of a lightly shipped love interest for the mom.
Hi.
Hello again.
You brought them home.
It's a service I provide.
All right.
Well, I'm also an escort. I came out wrong.
Yeah.
Look, the truth is I've always kind of wondered what lurked inside this haunt box.
Right. Well, the only thing lurking inside here is my slowly dying soul.
Is that what that smell is?
Well, it's not dinner, so. would you?
Sure.
Like?
Yeah.
I don't have any food.
It's okay. Fine.
Tour.
Great.
Great.
She's like terrible. She's like unemployed and drunk and mean. And he's just like, well, there just aren't new women in Oklahoma very often. So I'll put up with all of it. I'm a super good guy. You know? And we get like to a point where like they find Egon's lab and he has a couple tiers of like, they go through it. He has old books and Tobin's spirit guide makes an appearance.
Yeah.
As does a symmetrical book stack that no human would possibly ever make. Right.
Spoiler alert, Egon's haunting the house.
Yeah, as they settle into the house, they find out that an entity plays chess with Phoebe at night. And ultimately, the spirit in the house is revealed to be quite benevolent and helps her find and repair some of the ghost-busting equipment. It's not expressly revealed, but very strongly implied that it is Egon. They find out why he has moved to Oklahoma, which is that it is the site where Evo Shandor mined the mysterious magic metal that made up the apartment building in Ghostbusters 1. And Evo Shandor himself is entombed in the mine. And when they get down into the mine, they find out that Egon has placed a bunch of equipment that basically every time the spirit of Evo and the spirit of Gozer try to rise again, automated proton turrets in this AI system that he's built bust the ghost automatically and zap it and blast it back down into the lava depths of the mine. And those things have been running on their own for a few weeks and are failing when our family finds them. And so the setup is going to be that Evo Shandor is going to wake up and resummon Gozer. That's where it kind of went off the tracks for me, because they screwed around so long getting there that Shandor doesn't do anything. And they summon Gozer. Gozer, like, kind of just appears and fights them in a cornfield like the alien from Signs. Okay, and this is where the necromancy comes in, right? Actually, I guess all of that was necromancy, technically.
But I was going to say, do you mean for yourself? Or, like, did you miss the rest of it in the movie? You're doing necromancy on the podcast right now. That's what you're saying, right?
Phoebe, in the course of her research, finds a hotline number and she calls the number, and it's Ray, Dan Aykroyd's character, who is now running Ray, who's still running Ray's Occult Books.
And just as a trivia note, Ray's Occult Books is real. It exists in New York, and it is Dan Aykroyd's family's business that existed at the time of Ghostbusters 2, and they just repurposed for that movie. But yeah, that's where Dan Aykroyd's family makes their nut.
Does it operate as a bookstore? What is it?
Yeah, it's a bookstore for all of Dan Aykroyd's pet paranormal interests, which is a point in the movie that the bookstore itself is not self-sufficient and is actually supported by a cash cow. And I think that might be a little biographical about Dan Aykroyd. I don't know that bookstore would have stuck around had it not become famous and been propped up by a famous actor.
St. Mark's Deli is also real. Yum. But so yeah, so like, and then she gets the old Ghostbusters involved when they are all in over their head at the end of the movie. Venkman, Stance, and Zedmore show up as a deus ex machina. And they bust Gozer at the end as a group. Right at the key moment, in a very reminiscent of Conan, Do You Want to Live Forever? When Phoebe is about to get got, the full torso apparition of Egon appears and also busts. Which, does that make him like a ghost class traitor? Is that like a... Never mind. That was the tearjerker moment. That's what like all these hardcore Ghostbuster fans were really overcome by and like really got misty over. And I don't want to hate the thing, but it was a bit belabored. It went on a bit too long.
Yeah, they did linger on it a bit long. I'll give you that. I knew exactly the moment almost to the second that the OG Ghostbusters were going to step in and deus ex de machina. Like, I saw that coming, and I don't know that anybody else was surprised either. You knew they were going to show up, and you knew they were going to show up when the chips were down and nothing could be done at the most hopeless moment. But by the time it happened, I wasn't riding on Ghostbusters nostalgia juice. I was riding on Phoebe is cool juice. I was riding on podcast is my childhood insert juice. And when they show up, I'm like, I almost didn't need this moment. If Phoebe just got it together and stomped the pedal at the end, and we don't really meet the Ghostbusters until they show up to collect the equipment or whatever, I almost would have been fine with that. And I almost think the reason they didn't do that was because that was what everybody was expecting. They'll never get Bill Murray in there to bust ghosts again. It's just never going to happen. So I think there was kind of a feeling that they had to do something, but really they didn't do much. I thought the conversation with Ray was cute, But I also think if the hotline had gone through to Winston, it would have been a better move. But that's me armchair writing.
Winston has actually become the most financially successful Ghostbuster and is like a mogul. But for some odd reason, it's Ray monitoring the old hotline number.
Yeah, it's just patched through to the old bookstore.
The problem is that horning them in kind of introduces some big plot holes. Like, Ray and Egon had a tremendous falling out, and the Egon kind of cleaned them out and burgled all the firehouse equipment and ran off to Oklahoma with it, right?
Yeah, subsequently abandoning his family.
He knows that there is this gate to the Gozer dimension, wherever the Gozerian lives when it slumbers, right? And he feels that he has to live monastically over the top of this hellmouth and guard it for the world, and he doesn't want his family living with him. He no contacts them and moves. But then they also talk about how, like, oh, Egon lost his mind and was raving about some apocalypse. Like, why would the other three Ghostbusters not believe Egon Spengler when he says, I think Evo Shandor left another portal to the Gozerian dimension? They would, by all rights, look at Egon Spengler and go, that's perfectly consistent with our reality. We should all go together and deal with that. Not, you don't have to go live as a hermit. Yeah.
And like, especially when Ray is the established kind of, he was Egon's yes and part. He would have jumped on anything like that.
Structurally speaking, right? Shandor is in a tomb reminiscent of Lenin's tomb and begins to wake up during the finale. He's still kind of tepid, played by J.K. Simmons, and all he does is like open his eyes and sit up. Like, wasting J.K. Simmons is almost as great a crime as wasting Carrie Coon, you know? Paul Rudd is funny in this, but he doesn't do a lot. It's just a little too busy for all of them to get screen time.
They got Paul Rudd in that great role, and I think he was great in it. And when I realized that he was going to be the Lewis Tully of this movie, oh, you got me. I expected him to be the driver, the chauffeur. He was going to be the adult presence in the Ghostbusters reboot.
We should probably get out of here.
You're an adult.
Yeah. And liable.
You know what this means, right? Your grandfather was a Ghostbuster.
But nah, he was the heel. Well, not necessarily the heel, but he was the kind of innocuous, nerdy, down-the-hall neighbor that just kind of gets swept up in it all. And I liked that.
I sort of agree, but I think he could have just done both things. Like, they could have dropped Finn Wolfhard.
Right.
They could have dropped his girlfriend. Because those characters, realistically, are only in that movie to sell tickets to people that age.
Right. Agreed.
It's another one of those, I'm assuming that the demographic wants to watch themselves. And just have Paul Rudd and the mom do everything that Finn Wolfhard and the girl did, except maybe fix the car. Because one thing Finn Wolfhard does is he finds the decrepit Ecto-1 and restores it.
Too hot to handle, too cold to hold. They called the Ghostbusters and the end control. Had a throwing party for a bunch of children. Well, all the while, the slime was under the building. So they packed up, regrouped, got a grip, came equipped, grabbed their proton packs on the back, then they split. Found out about Viggo, the master of evil. Try to battle my boys.
Geeks, nerds, devotees of all worlds, lend me your ears. A community of inclusion and passion awaits you at oneofus.net. Movie and music reviews, debates on books and beer, deep dives into comics and games. There's something for everyone because everyone loves something. Podcast posts daily with subscriptions. You get video content as well. All are welcome because in this world of fandom and fanaticism, all of us are in this together. Your love of pop culture and entertainment makes you one of us already. So join us today at oneofus.net.
First ghost they chase is this, like, I believe he's called Muncher.
Metal Muncher, yeah.
But he is a Slimer, except instead of liking human food, he likes to eat metal. When agitated, he screams and shoots bolts out of his mouth like a machine gun, which is cool. Like, it was a cool ghost busting scene, and he's a neat ghost, and he's Slimer-like.
Sure.
But you just about could have just used Slimer. It was like just a little junked up, and you could have had Shandor wake up at the halfway point and walk into town, and then they wouldn't have to do this like subplot where they find the mine by accident because the teenagers are like throwing bottles into it, you know.
I will say that J.K. Simmons, as just even having Shandor in the movie, was wasted. I think it is a cool moment when he is reckoned with by Gozer and shown indifference.
Or you have Shandor still be running the town as an immortal old man, and he's like, oh, no, I'm Evo the 10th. You must be mistaking me for my grandfather.
And I thought that's what they were going to go with, is kind of like an old Innsmouth kind of H.P. Lovecraft thing. But alas.
Yeah, and have all and I think, believe it or not, like speaking of parallels with 2016, where the finale was famously like kind of butchered and re-edited. It had this sequence where the villain enchants a big unit of SWAT team guys and stuff and makes them dance.
And they have a full musical number, yeah.
I think that the finale, or the scene where they're trying to bust Muncher by driving through town in the Ecto-1, and some of the weird reactions and stuff they have to townspeople, lead me to believe that more of that Innsmouth cultish feeling was in some version of this movie.
Interesting. Okay.
And the town is depressed because the mine is shut. Then you set Paul Rudd as like the, because he's a seismologist, I believe, by trade, and is teaching high school science to get by.
Summer high school science, yeah.
He is keenly interested in all the microquakes that are happening at the mine, which he initially thinks have to do with like fracking, right? Which is good. That's a good hook. I like that.
Sure.
Ton of working, maybe a few too many good ideas, I would say, plagued this movie, right?
I would co-sign on that.
I did not like the prolonged sequence with Egon's ghost at the end. It was just a little too long and a little too maudlin, and the guys looked a little too old and broke down for me. I was like, God, man, I know he's Bill Murray and it's hard to tell him what to do, but shit, you could put him on keto for a couple weeks, you know? got his coveralls tailored and taken in a little, you know, maybe a little structure in the shoulders.
Some padding.
Like I said, I'm dumping on it nonstop, but I truly didn't hate it. I thought it definitely more worked than did not work. It's worth a ticket price, but I did not get the same, and I'm not alluding merely to nostalgia. It's fundamentally not the same type of critter as Ghostbusters, and not in a torch passing way. Like we're iterating the genre, but leaving the spirit alone, like Alien to Aliens. It's more of like when we sat down and made a list of what made Ghostbusters great, we made a really different list than you would make. Because to me, the number one thing that I look to Ghostbusters for is like the Lebowski tier dialogue. This had some punchy one-liners. Phoebe in particular is super funny.
Yeah, see, but it's a different kind of humor. It's definitely more of a kid's adventure film humor than, it's more Goonies than Ghostbusters.
Perfect. Exactly. Write that in the sky in Gossamer teardrops. That is a reference to a Patton Oswalt joke. That joke is for Nick.
Oh.
No, I mean, I'm glad it came out. Although, can we talk about the man boys now?
Okay, let's talk about the man boys. Like, I have been so unplugged, Matt. I was in, you know, this was kid in hospital time for me. And so I actually have no idea how this was received. Like, what are people saying?
The people that hated 2016 the most are insufferably happy with this. Because they're like, yeah, it gave us our Venkmans back and our still a little too much girl. But maybe I'm being a hipster. Maybe I'm finding fault with the people that like it and not the movie. And I do know a lot of like just sincere Ghostbusters fans that also really liked it because it had, you know, they got to see that proton pack again. They got to see, you know, the guys again, right? Yeah. Annie Potts has a great, more than a cameo, but she's the executor, and she's there when they show up to claim the house. We don't get closure on what happened between the Egon Lewis Janine triangle, which I would like to see done as a series. Like, just can you imagine a comedy where Lewis Tully and Egon Spengler are like spy versus spying each other for the hand of Janine? And like Egon keeps building these massive, like he's the coyote and Tully's the roadrunner.
Right?
I guess a way I might articulate it is, if they're gonna do that much fan service, why have so much reboot of elements if we're gonna wallow in it, like, why not fill us in on what the guys have been doing? If you're gonna have them do cameos, they were in it too much to be cameos, and they were in it too little to be a true Ghostbusters 3.
I think that's
fair. It came off a little Deus Ex Machina-y. I would have really liked to see, like, Ray and Venkman show up and teach them to bust ghosts. Like, that would have been on the level of, if you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge a ball, you know?
Yeah. You know, I think that would have been a big ask from Bill Murray, who has been, like, notoriously the one who is dragging his feet on a third Ghostbusters movie.
Oh, why? So he can make The Dead Don't Die and waste 2 hours of all of our fucking time? Oh, Jim, you just cut from camera A to camera B. Should we say the name of the movie again? That seems like maybe tonight the dead don't die. Look into camera. 3, 2, 1. Painful. You were in Life Aquatic. Come on.
Now, what I do think is, if you stay after the credits, there is a mid-credit scene that's a little fan service for the Bill Murray Sigourney Weaver set. You want to talk about wasting a cameo? Sigourney Weaver should have done something.
It is nice to see that they stayed together. That does soften the overall legendary boorishness of Peter Venkman.
Sure. But I do like the setup that they're giving Winston. Number one, this is a giant apology to just the short sheet that Ernie Hudson as a performer has gotten through this whole franchise. He's always the Ghostbuster that's left out of the PR materials, the press materials, the posters, etc. And if you watch the most recent Ghostbusters making of documentary Cleaning Up the Town, he gets a little candid talking about the fact that, hey, when this role was written for Eddie Murphy, Winston had all the best lines. He was the blue-collar worker reacting to all the weird psychobabble. This was really funny, and when it stopped being Eddie and started being Ernie, the part started getting cut, and then pretty soon I'm not in until the second act. Number one, that documentary is really fantastic, and you should check it out. And there are some very candid, refreshing looks, especially some good ones that are digging on Bill Murray for his reluctance to come back, specifically by Annie Potts, who just takes a straight-up swipe at him.
Ernie Hudson is also, like, I think out of all of them, he actually acts the most.
Agreed.
He's still in the best shape.
And so I like that they're kind of setting him up to be the Charlies to the Charlie's Angels of this new generation of Ghostbuster. I think he's got potential to kind of carry the franchise into the future, and him and Annie Potts would be a great combo on that. I think Rick Moranis has recently come out of retirement. Let's drive a dump truck full of money up to his house, and that would be a fun thing. Yeah, and I want more of Winston. I want more of Phoebe. I want something to be done with Trevor. It would be nice if my namesake had a little more to do. But I think that's my final argument, and I'll say it again. I said it before. There's not a criticism you've come up with, Matt, that I disagree with. I think all of it is valid. I think it makes a lot of sense. I think I just maybe bought in harder on the premise and I just had more fun with it. For whatever reason, it didn't take me out of the film and I just had a good time. I had a better time with this, I think, than I did with the 2016 Ghostbusters. I think I had to extend my willing suspension of disbelief a little bit on that. But at the end of the day, yeah, I'm glad. Let's do more. I'm happy. What's next? I think having to sit on it for a year definitely tempered my expectations. That probably worked to this movie's advantage.
I'm going to call this one, and this is a common call in this day and age. It's not a unique thought.
Uh-huh.
This would make a great comedy series. The other thing is, like, the paranormal world has changed, right? So, like, Ernie Hudson is the occasional guest star that owns the firehouse, and he drops and tasks a new team of Ghostbusters. I don't know if Finn Wolfhard would stoop to this, you know, and just have them come in and out. Just imagine an episode of an hour-long Ghostbusters episodic thing where, like, they deal with, like, a Zach Bagans. He just comes into their office in desperation. He's like, yo, we found a real one. We found a real one, dog. Like, I was like, yo, what up, demons of hell? come mess with Zach. I ain't the one. I ain't the one. That's which one I am. I ain't the one. And like, something frankly gouged my nuts off. Have you ever watched any of that stuff where he's like, oh yeah, if you're a real ghost, if you're a real tough poltergeist, why don't you push me down these steps? Why don't you pick on someone your own size instead of the people that live in this house that are my size?
Right.
Where does he still get them jeans?
Well, Matt, I will say this. We teased this a little earlier and I said I was going to come back to it. And I said, I think I have a response, really. I may have said, I think I have an answer, but really it's more of a response to the note that the mother character in this movie is really given nothing to do and is kind of fridged and is very poorly treated. That is all true as well. But I will say there is nothing that you can say about that that isn't also true of Sigourney Weaver in the first film. The biggest problem in this case is that the business that they are giving her to do is Sigourney Weaver's business from the first movie.
Well, no, they don't even really give her that, though, because she's not...
Well, they give her the heavy panting, the heavy breathing, the deep voice talking. It's there, but it's heavily cribbing on you remembering Dana from the first film.
Yeah, it's there as a reference, and then they pivot to Lucky. It's another thing where, like, I almost think what they realized is it would be creepy with two teenagers and too shipped with the people that were actually trying to date. So they were like, why don't we have Paul Rudd be the keymaster and then the gatekeeper will move around. And then after they do the thing, and it's not creepy because it was the two adults, then we'll have the actual terror dog get Lucky.
And that's what I'll say. The bigger sin here is not that they did.
Lucky is the name of the character for the audience who hasn't seen it. The terror dog does not get Lucky. It possesses a person named Lucky.
And I think, actually, Lucky was probably a little more mistreated than the mother. She really is just Finn Wolfhard's object of conquest.
What are you doing here in Somerville, anyway?
Honestly, my mom won't say it, but we're broke. We just got evicted, and the only thing that's left in our name is this creepy old farmhouse our grandfather left us in the middle of nowhere. No offense.
I'm not offended. This place is a dump.
Then why do you live here?
I'm fourth generation dump. So. Get out!
What is that?
And then when she suits up with the team, then she almost literally gets fridged by becoming a terror dog, because terror dogs in the first movie live in the fridge, and becomes Finn Wolfhard's reason to twat to bust a ghost. And that was just like, I'm like, why even have her there, except that you needed a fourth person?
Final rant. Why does Gozer just appear as old Gozer?
Good point.
Why does Gozer appear?
Good point.
And then they, like, I was expecting, like, after they zot Gozer 2, I was expecting there to be like, oh, Gozer's going to come back as like the town mascot or the high school sports mascot or something. They're going to like close that. Maybe she appears as a slur and we find out what it means to be roasted in the belly of a slur. You know, like, I didn't think they were just going to be done. I really did not like that end fight that was so confined, and it lacked any of the, like, the temple fight at the end of Ghostbusters 1 is like, it has some scope and scale. It feels pretty big and epic, and she feels very, when she comes out of that portal and walks down those steps and then does the flippity flips, like, you're like, oh, this is an intimidating entity. She's literally above them several tiers, you know? Like, the joke of Ghostbusters is that somebody called an exterminator to deal with a nuclear situation, right?
Right.
Like, because that's what they are. It's like someone called a plumber to fix a volcano. That's the core gag of the Ghostbusters, right? What they do is, from that, they wrestle out that, like, you know, the great moment where Venkman hides and doesn't get any marshmallow on him, you know? Stuff like that is really, like, from that premise, they wrestle out, like, oh, these guys actually have a lot of folksy wisdom, you know? This movie didn't have it didn't want its characters to go there. Like, it didn't want them to be made fun of. because they kind of worked hard to get them sort of to seem plausibly serious. So it just didn't all gel as good for me. Because the other part of the joke at the end of Ghostbusters 1 is that they're all these, what are they, about 35? And they're like, yeah, we're probably going to die, you know? And so like when they decide to go up the steps and fight Gozer, and they're going out in a blaze of glory, and at least people are cheering for them, and they're going to go up there and just like, okay, well, let's fuck it up. and they couldn't, like, you can't have two little kids be that nihilistic.
Right.
Like, you can't. Like, Phoebe almost could.
She gets close. Because
of her characterization.
Yeah.
They can't have those grade school kids be like, eh, it's a good day to die. Let's get this bitch, you know? like they did in one. The solution to that would be to have that big, fun kaiju set piece in the and have it wreck the small town, right? Which is what we all wanted to see. I wanted to see that burger barn get toasted even worse. But maybe that's just me. I don't know. Am I crazy? Have I been listening to too much of The Studio Demands with TC and Jim?
No, but I have been enjoying some The Studio Demands It with TC and Jim myself. Did a lot of catching up over the hospital time. That Deep Space Nine episode was fantastic. I loved it. And then in a timely fashion, they just did an Indiana Jones episode, which is something that we also covered not too long ago. So, yeah, it's been fun listening to that. Definitely put that on your podcast list. And while you're doing it, put us on your podcast list. Write, review, rate, give us all your love. Yeah, you can find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter, find us on Instagram. We have an Instagram now. And keep your eyes peeled. I think we're going to have some more animatic content. I actually don't know that we've been able to pimp the most recent animatic on any of our existing episodes. Episode 2 of the animatics is out, folks. It is our Monstoberfest animatic for our abbreviated Monstoberfest this year. So definitely give that a look at nighthawkspodcast.com, where you can also find our backlog of episodes and some original artwork, that type of thing. Otherwise, guys, we're going to wrap this up. It's been good. It was a good time at the movies. Matt, you got anything else?
Buy my pirate cripplers. This is Precious Roy signing off.
It is literally morning.
Yeah, we look good.
But then you came and he soon departed. And you know he never showed his face again. That's why your love keeps on lifting me higher, higher and higher.
Yeah, it's been fun listening to that. Definitely put that on your podcast list. And while you're doing it, put us on your podcast. Pat.
Ha. Yeah, give us a... Throw us a little rate and review there. It helps us out.
Yeah, so I'm going to take that again. While you're putting them on your podcast list, put us on your podcast list.
Hey, everybody. I'm Alan Barber.
And I'm Kirk Klinger.
And we are the hosts of a podcast called You've Never Heard This.
You've Never Heard This?
You've Never Heard This. It's been brought to our attention by the wonderful hosts of the Nighthawks podcast that we use the word new in our promo that they so graciously play on every episode.
And we are not new, Alan.
We are not new. We are no spring chickens.
We're not.
We've been doing this a while.
We've been around. Doesn't mean we know what we're doing.
No, not at all. But we certainly like to pretend.
We try.
If you love music, then yes, you'll love this podcast. It's like a book club, except you don't have to do the homework.
Absolutely.
And we hope that you will join us, talking about everything from Soundgarden to Billie Eilish to the Dresden Dolls to Korn.
Little of everything, really.
Little bit of everything.
We have fun.
We do. We have a good time. So we hope that you will join us. Enjoy our podcast. We can be found on just about every platform you can think of. Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, most recently, Amazon Music and Audible.
Nice.
You have no excuse to not find us.
Yes. So you've never heard us.
Every Tuesday.
So check out
the podcast.
You've never never heard this.